Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, editor of Total Film, and welcome to the subscriber version of Inside Total Film. And as always, thank you for taking out a subscription. We really appreciate it. Today, I'm joined by our news editor, Jordan Farley.
Hello.
And our contributor, Ashanti Romkar.
Hi.
Hi, both. So this week, we're going to be rating horror redo, Candyman, 80s drama, The Nest, teenage romp, Our Ladies, Arabic drama, Suad, and comedy, Vacation Friends. But before we start on those, what have you guys been watching this week? Ashanti, what have you been sticking your eyes on?
All the food.
Well, obviously, she's been sticking her eyes on Caramax, because we've been discussing Caramax at great length, which she has to eat during this, which is one of the best foods. But apart from that...
It is. Well, we binged through The Chair. It came out on Netflix, and wow, I love Sandra Oh, and I was waiting to see her doing something a bit different, and here she was as The Chair. And I grew up on university campuses all my life because my dad is an academic, so it kind of had this appeal to me just from reading the description, saying, this is going to be a good one. And Jay Duplass, I mean, I didn't realize his eyes twinkled so much. It's like he actually looked really, really cute in this. And I absolutely loved it, just because there were 30-minute episodes as well. Kudos Netflix for keeping that really short, and just back to back, watched the whole thing in one evening. Nana Mensa as one of the kind of young faculty members. It was really nice to see that as well, because you had, you know, Sandra Oh, you had Jay Duplass, Bob Balaban, all these people just coming together in this show. Really enjoyed it. So that was definitely one of those that I watched. The other one, and I don't know whether you've already done something on this, but Snake Eyes, G.I. Joe Origins. I went into it very skeptically, and I actually quite enjoyed it. It's definitely flawed. It is no Shang-Chi, but I really enjoyed seeing kind of Henry Golding. I mean, he's good in everything he does, and he's got a lot of range with his acting. And, you know, the whole cast looked really good. Lots of kind of kick-ass fight scenes, and Iko Uwe, whom I saw in The Raid, and I thought, whoa, this guy is amazing. And he hasn't had much of a chance to do much in cinema. They keep giving him weird roles, and even in this, I felt like they should have really expanded his role a little bit. But hey, maybe this opens up for many more sequels. And I quite enjoyed it. I just thought it was a nice action movie, and it was nice to see another type of superhero in many ways.
What have you been watching, Jordan?
Well, earlier this week, I saw Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings, which is very exciting. We'll obviously be discussing it
next week.
In full next week when we'll be reviewing it. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I would say, in brief, probably has the best kind of fight choreography and action scenes of any film in the MCU, possibly. Simu Liu made a really great first impression for me. It kind of lost the plot a little bit towards the end, but I still enjoyed it immensely.
I'm seeing it next week, so I will wait until next week to discuss that one. I've been watching, because everyone was banging on about it, so it's like, I better get onto this, The White Lotus. And I binged watched that because, quite apart from anything else, just enjoyed being on a holiday watching it and being in a tropical environment and thinking, oh God, do you remember what it's like when you went to like hotels and there was breakfast buffets and you sat by a pool and things like that and went on day trips? Oh, those are the days. But I really enjoyed it. I loved Connie Britton in it, and the fact that it's such a sort of interesting look at, you know, white entitlement and just entitlement in general, you know, whether that's, you know, race or your monetary standing, or whether it's being an American and in a service industry, you're like an American in the service industry and not one of the people who actually are from the islands. Very, very interesting. And pretty much nobody was likable in it, which is also a plus in my book. I really enjoy a nasty old drama. And that was a good one. So I'm going to try Nine Perfect Strangers next, which I hope will be in a similar vein with people arriving at a luxury resort that I can enjoy like warm face towels and smoothies and things, but also just horrible individuals. Have you seen The White Lotus, you guys?
I have. Yes. And I really liked it. That was another one I binged all the way through.
Yeah, in contrast to you, it actually completely put me off the idea of going on holiday, because I was just thinking, I just can't put up with this level of passive aggression from everyone around me. Like, and much more comfortable at home, I think.
Yeah, and also, like, this is a 5-star resort. I'm not going to a 5-star resort anytime soon. This is, you know, a little window into a world that I'm not familiar with. I don't go to those sort of hotels. So, yeah, good luck to them all. Hope you all enjoy your warm face towels. Anyway, shall we move on to something a little bit more gritty, a little bit more grounded, not a daiquiri in sight. It's time to look in the mirror because it's time for this.
Candyman. The urban legend is, if you say his name 5 times while looking in the mirror, he appears in the reflection and kills you.
Who would do that?
Candyman.
Well, we're still alive.
Candyman.
Stop! Stop! What are you doing?
I'm not looking into a mirror, it's fine.
I did a post about it and I've got a little bite on my left.
Oh my God.
Just be careful, Jordan, because even though you're not looking in a mirror, you are looking at yourself on screen and it might count. And all I'm saying is, if you've said it that many times, don't blame me if somebody comes to you in the night. Why don't you tell us what Candyman is about?
So this is the Naya Costa directed, Jordan Peele produced sequel to the 1992 horror film, probably fair to call it a horror classic. It's set 30 years after the events of the first film in the now gentrified Cabrini Green district of Chicago, where yuppies and rich millennials live in towering apartment buildings that have replaced all the old kind of council housing. It stars Yahya Abdul-Mateen II as a struggling artist called Anthony and Teona Paris as his girlfriend Brianna, who is a much more successful sort of gallery director. Early in the story, Anthony learns about the Candyman from Brianna's brother, played by a very funny Nathan Stewart Gerrett. It's a story that's become a kind of urban legend in the 3 decades since the events of the first film, and Anthony is kind of consumed with, in more ways than one, actually, by the idea of this hook-handed killer born of trauma and injustice who murderizes anyone who dares say his name 5 times in the mirror.
Murderizes.
And it really kind of, I mean, he really murderizes them. Like, they get cut to ribbons in this film. So there are a few things that this film does really well. First and foremost, as you might expect from a film co-written by Jordan Peele, it has a lot to say about the Black experience in America, about historic trauma and how that's being reckoned with today. So it feels relevant and vital in a way that certainly no Candyman sequel has since the first film. A lot of those Candyman sequels are kind of throwaway and a bit rubbish, to be honest. And even though I wasn't a huge fan of Naya da Costa's first film, Little Woods, I think this is a much more accomplished film for her as a director. Certainly visually, there are some really striking kind of motifs involving mirrors and reflections in this film that help build this really tangible sense of dread throughout the film. And there are these kind of shadow puppet fairy tale sequences that essentially recount the story of the first film. That's all incredibly well done. And there are a couple of really classic kind of Candyman set pieces, including one in this neon lit art gallery. And there's another one which is in a high school girl's bathroom, which is just really nasty in a kind of satisfying way. And it's a surprisingly lean kind of 90 minutes as well. It's kind of in and out and very punchy. But I would say it didn't work for me entirely. I do have a couple of bugbears with this film. The main one being that it goes to great lengths to expand on the mythology of Candyman. And if you've seen the first film, you know, you'd assume that Tony Todd's Daniel Rubitaille is the Candyman in this film, but that's not necessarily the case. There are kind of numerous Candymen, and the way you kind of become a Candyman left me a little bit confused by the end of it. Like, it kind of muddies the water a bit too much on what I felt was quite a clean mythology in the first film. And it also, to me, felt like a film that didn't entirely trust its audience in the sense that it's constantly kind of hammering its message home in a way that I felt a bit hammered on the head by it. Like, I thought a little bit of subtlety could have gone a long way with this film. But overall, I did really enjoy it. And like I say, that sense of dread is so tangible throughout the entire film. I thought that it really had something going for it with that.
How did you like it, Shanti? I mean, I know you're not that keen on a horror film, are you?
I'm not. I am normally terrified, which is why I haven't seen the first Candyman. I went into this completely cold, warned everyone who was sitting near me that I might scream. And I said the same, you know, when we went to see Us at the, you know, the press screening of Us, I'd warned everyone on that row that, you know, it might be me screaming. But I actually feel that someone like Jordan Peele seems to be able to take that genre and then give it a twist that turns it into social commentary, which I really like. And I didn't scream during Us. I didn't scream during Candyman. There were many scenes that I couldn't look at the camera, especially at the screen, sorry, because I was quite, you know, like, oh, this is just icky and disgusting. And that happens quite a lot. It happened to me at Suicide Squad as well, because there were lots of nasty looking things, and I don't like those aliens and things like that on screen. If they're kind of robotic, I'm okay with them, but if they're robotic and they seep stuff, I just don't like it. So
as we've discussed before, you don't like a mucus in a film, do you?
Spot on when it's
any sort of bodily fluid, we're not into.
So, not into at all.
But talk about the social commentary on this, you know, like, did you get a lot out of it? Did you think it had something to say?
Absolutely. So for me, this worked totally. It's like Jordan Peele, as I mentioned, he does bring that in. And it's like the third in a trilogy in many ways, because Get Out had a lot of that, where the Black American experience has been taken and shown to you. And then, you know, when he did Us again, I felt that I resonated with what he was trying to tell us with it. With this, he trusted Mia to take the story on. And I think she's done a fantastic job with it, because it's horror-filled. You know, the visuals and the metaphors are all horror-filled. And you kind of see the collective trauma of the Black American experience. And I mean, I watch a lot of stuff. I'm married to a Black man, and I watch a lot of what's going on in the US. And this actually brings it. And as Jordan said, yes, it's true that it's very obvious. They show it to you without making it too subtle. But I liked that about it, because I felt that this is a message and a kind of awareness that works in a film format. And this sort of thing can help bring change, because people who are watching it are seeing a mirror to what's going on in society in America. And again, the puppetry showing you the Candyman and the hive of people who have been traumatized across the ages really worked well, because that was a very strong set of imagery that they brought. And it was done in a very strong and very sensitive way, which I really liked. And this had a very tense narrative. The actors were all fantastic in it. And that kind of collective trauma just came out to me. It felt like a 3D hitting us, you know, that this is the collective trauma of what Black Americans continue to face. So this is not something that happened in the past, it's what's happening in the present. And, you know, Nia taking this on and having a woman director taking this on, I felt that also made it feel quite pertinent to what's going on in 2021 and beyond. So I feel this is great. And with Nia, she's very promising. We want to see what she does with the Marvels, and here she is giving us a glimpse of what she can do and how she's taken what was a, you know, a cult film and given it this twist. And everyone in the cinema clapped, and there were a lot of people of color in the screening I was at yesterday night, and everyone clapped at the end. I think they all really got it, and it kind of hit us, because, you know, walking to the station, my husband and I were chatting a lot about it and how it just hit the nail on the head.
That sounds like a perfect weekend out, doesn't it? You get all the fun of the fair, of the horror, but also you've got quite a lot to think about and chat about after.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's really interesting, because obviously the original Candyman, 1992, is directed by Bernard Rose, who's a white man, based on a short story by Clive Barker, another white man. But, you know, the original Candyman is socially relevant. It's a story about, you know, a Black man who is lynched and essentially comes back for revenge. Mm. It's not without a social conscience. That's really the central framing of the narrative. That's what this whole film is about. Like, it's less about the thrills, and it's more about what it is saying about America and what it's reflecting in the mirror back at America. So that stuff was all, you know, incredibly powerful. As a horror film, it's not the most thrilling, I would say. It's almost treated like a drama at points. Like the kind of murders and the chills are quite few and far between. So if you're going in expecting, like, you know, a Conjuring, like a kind of jump scare movie, it's not
You're not going to get it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not like the roller coaster horror film that you might be hoping for. But I would say there's a bit more to it, which makes it a bit more interesting. So if you're willing to go with it, then it's definitely worth checking out. And just as a critic, it was quite fun because there's a kind of snooty art critic character in it who I really enjoyed, who's basically like, you know, a live action Anton Ego from Ratatouille, who's like very sniffy about Anthony's artwork initially. And then when he becomes kind of implicated with these murders related to the Candyman, she takes on this kind of morbid fascination with his work. So I just found that all like quite amusing. I mean, it's quite arch and it's quite knowing in that it's kind of making fun of critics a little bit, but that was all very enjoyable.
Cool. So if you would like to see Candyman, it is out this Friday in cinemas at the big screen. Take it and just be careful what you do in the loos when you're looking in the mirror afterwards, I guess. Okay, so shall we move on? It's time to live beyond our means with this.
There's an opportunity.
Where?
London.
This would be our fourth move in 10 years.
Turn backwards.
But money's fine, right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. This is a fresh start.
How about this?
You shouldn't be working for someone else. Be your own boss. Build your own place. Own your own horses.
Something doesn't feel right.
So this is The Nest, a shanty. Is it about a nest? What's going on here?
In this case, The Nest is a huge, very eerie house. And I actually was expecting this to be a real horror film, but it actually is horror, but real life horror. So it actually is almost a companion piece to Candyman in that sense. But in this case, you're going kind of going back in time to the 80s. And, you know, we've seen this sort of film where there's this husband who's, you know, all he wants to do is to make lots of money. And in this case, you know, here he is, Jude Law with his American wife, Carrie Coon, and they decide to leave New York City, which is full of bustle, and just move to this huge kind of beautiful house in England. And what can I say? A lot of things start to unravel because the house itself is eerie. And I have this when I go to certain places, I get these slight chills. They're very cold. And I could just feel that in the way they brought this film to life. I could feel this house almost. And they made it quite, you know, visceral in that sense. And here they are, this family go there and with these two children, and their life is upturned completely. Because how do you live in New York one day and then go to this countryside place, and there's horseback riding and there's expensive private schools? Everything changes for them. And Alison, the woman who plays the wife, this is her character, and she's already quite freaked out by what is going on. Her husband, on the other hand, and Jude Law is a brilliant actor, he's there just to kind of, I'm going to make this money. And it's a very traditional kind of old days, this is how we did it. I'm the breadwinner, you're the wife and the family, I'll provide for you, I'll do everything I can, and I'll put, you know, all my focus on that. And, you know, this woman, she has what I would say is a bit of a breakdown living there. She's so isolated in this house, and this is the setup of it, because the film itself, I would say, it's a very slow burner. Mm-hmm. And I personally thought I would like it more than I did. So I watched this for the Sundance BIFA jury. And it was one of those films that I actually went into thinking, this is going to be on point. I'm really going to like this film. But I didn't like it, surprisingly.
Oh, I loved it.
Did you love it? You know, it's weird.
I absolutely loved it. I watched this and I was like, you know, I thought, I think I've seen one of the films that's going to be in my top 10 of the year. I just thought everything about it was so beautifully sort of measured, from the acting from Jude Law, which I love him in this kind of role. It's a sort of bit of a talented Mr. Ripley, Dickie Greensleeve kind of role where he's just money, 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 80s sort of city guy. and Carrie Coomer just thought was so lovely, so sort of snarky with her husband, but also like she's the absolute sanity in this relationship. For me, it was like a little bit sort of like The Shining, you know, the Jack Nicholson husband going bananas and the wife realizing that something's not quite right. Not that Jude Law's character does actually lose it. He loses sense of perspective, let's say. And the wife is there trying to actually keep that family together and keep it grounded. And just the camera work, the score, the actual location, as you say, it's this big old house where they actually do sort of wedding receptions. It's this beautiful old house, but they make it into this foreboding, overpowering, dank place that is sort of creeping over them, that's just suffocating them.
It's definitely a character in the film, the house.
Yeah, I loved it. Jordan, did you, were you like a meh or a love?
I really liked it too. I wouldn't go as far to say that I loved it, but I did really, really like it. Yeah, I've been looking forward to this film for a long time. Only the second feature film from Sean Durkin, who directed Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene a decade ago, which is insane. It's taken him 10 years to make his second film, but I almost felt this was worth the wait. Yeah, like you say, it's such a ravishing sort of film. I really loved the performances in this, especially. And Rory, the character that Jude Law plays, is just one of those great, infuriating film characters. Mm. He really reminded me of like Adam Sandler's character in Uncut Gems, in the sense that he's just incredibly frustrating because he can never be satisfied with what he's got. He's constantly spending money he doesn't have, just for no reason, really. I mean,
he's all about risk, isn't he?
Yeah, the reasons are like deep-seated childhood trauma, but... You know, I mean, like if he didn't just spend every penny, he'd probably be perfectly fine. So it's this really sort of fascinating portrait of a marriage put under completely unnecessary strain by this toxic patriarch who likes to pretend that he's rich when he actually isn't that wealthy at all. I thought the film did a really interesting job of, you know, exploring Rory's psychology. There's a really great scene kind of halfway through where he goes to visit his mother for the first time in well over a decade, I think. And he goes there expecting like a hero's welcome. You know, the prodigal son has returned, but she's just completely indifferent to the fact that he's back. And he's almost begging her to come and see this ridiculous mansion that he's living in with his family, just showing off to her, really. And she just couldn't care less, and nothing could frustrate him more in that moment, I don't think. He's such an interesting character. And then Carrie Coon, I don't think I've ever seen her give a better performance. I mean, she's a great actress, but she's so wonderful here. Just basically takes none of Rory's shit, and it's just so enjoyable and fun to watch. And if it does sound like a bit of a drag, it's not. There are some really funny scenes and moments in this film. I was tickled like a surprising amount given how dark and serious the subject matter can get.
I also like the scenes of the bankers that he's surrounded by. His boss in particular is a really entertaining chap. And you know, seeing this guy who has gone to America and sort of got this pioneer American can-do spirit, brought it back to London and thinks he can just, you know, will riches into existence by sheer want and like go-getterness. And within this sort of very staid establishment London city atmosphere, his boss is just, no mate, that, you know, that's just not how it works here. And the clashing of two sort of lifestyles and ethos as well is just really fascinating. As you say, I really enjoyed it.
Two out of three. I'm in the minority here. I was going to give a shout out to Adil Akhtar, actually.
Oh yeah, he's good in this.
We saw him in Sweet Tooth, and he seems to be nailing all his roles of late. And I did like that about this film. And I have to say that the two kids in this also, they give, the performances were all there. For some reason, the film didn't work for me. I wonder whether it was the pacing, because
it's very cold, isn't it?
Yes. On paper, this film should have worked for me 100%. And, you know, everything, the sound design, the cinematography, everything was there. But it didn't speak to me.
It's another one as well that I always, I mean, I think this every time I see Jude Law in something. I think because Alfie and things like that sort of made him a bit of a sort of flashy, sort of not really resonant actor. And then you see him in things like this and you think, God, he's so good. You know, this sort of performance reminded me of him in Closer. And I loved him in Closer as that needy guy who was after Natalie Portman. I think he's really good. And I think this is a, if you want to see Jude being really, really excellent and what he's really capable of, this is a film to see. So that is The Nest, and that is out in cinemas on Friday. So it's time for alternative line reading, and I'm just going to give you a clue now that I've just said how much I love a certain actor. So here you go. Here's the one. It's better to be a fake somebody than a real nobody.
I think I know.
Go on then.
Should I say it?
Say it.
I'm assuming this is The Talented Mr. Ripley.
It is. Well done.
Yeah.
Jude Law.
I mean, you gave the game away by literally just mentioning The Talented Mr. Ripley.
Did I? Oh, probably shouldn't have. I do love that film though.
It is great. It is
so
awesome.
Good.
And I love Jude in that as well. And I love Matt Damon. He managed to make himself such a weedy little, ratty little guy in those Day-Glo sort of speedos. He scuttles up the beach to sit next to Jude Law doing his best bronze god. And, you know, I love that film. And that's also another one that made me want to go on holiday.
I always thought it'd be better to be a fake somebody than a real nobody.
Well done, Jordan. You get the prize.
Thank you.
Well done. Okay, moving on. Time to pack your weekend clothes in your school bag. It's time for this.
It was a different time then. Before social media and mobile phones changed everything forever. It was 1996.
Some of you are going to Edinburgh for the first time today. You will carry yourselves with grace. But I must warn you, there are men there that would use and discard girls like you. Yes, Fionnuala?
See, when you say use and discard, sister, how do you mean?
So this is Our Ladies. Who are Our Ladies? They sound like a very reputable and holy group of young ladies. Jordan, are they?
Not exactly. If I tell you this film is essentially Derry Girls meets Superbad, then you probably get a sense of who these ladies are exactly. So it's adapted from the confusingly named 1998 novel The Sopranos, but has nothing to do with New York wise guys. Instead, it's set in 1996 and follows five working class Catholic schoolgirls who travel to Edinburgh, ostensibly to compete in a choir competition, but they end up spending most of their time gallivanting around the city, drinking, partying, and hooking up with basically anyone who will look their way. So it's an incredibly kind of boisterous film, driven by these five bawdy central performances. Importantly, the film doesn't judge these characters for acting the way that they do. They're just who they are. They can be quite cruel to each other at times and complete strangers. They swear, they drink, they smoke. This is just part of their life and is a reaction to their working class upbringing in a remote town in Scotland where you get the impression there's not really much to do except get drunk and kiss boys, basically. Each character brings quite a different shade to the story. There's one character called Orla who has survived leukemia. So she has a very kind of positive and sunny kind of outlook on life. And this sort of joyous lust for life. There's another character who is closeted, and the trip to Edinburgh is an opportunity for her to kind of be herself and not worry about what other people might think of her in the small town that she lives in. So there's quite a lot going on with each of these characters, and music plays a big part in the film as well, to the extent that it almost feels like a Scottish commitment.
That's what it reminded me of.
I just thought this was tons of fun. I really enjoyed this. I really liked all the performances, all the characters. It's a bit of a slight film, you know, it's not going to change your world. It's not going to rock your world. But I would say this was probably one of the more purely enjoyable films that I watched this week.
Yeah, agreed. I sort of recognise quite a bit of this, having gone to an all-girls school and recognising that sort of, well, certainly the packing your clothes in your bag and getting changed in the interchange bus toilets and going off and getting your cigarettes out and trying to get into various nightclubs and stuff. I could totally recognise that. And, you know, 1996 and the music and everything, very evocative of a certain time. Some things were just a bit weird, though, like one character whose dream of losing her virginity being tied to a tree and being whipped with rosary beads was a bit like, I get they're wild, but that's a bit weird for a teenage girl to fancy, isn't it?
That's just Catholic repression,
just
right?
Catholic that's repression. Like... and I was pleasantly surprised to see a certain star of that era who was referenced a couple of times in the film appeared in the credit sequence. I did enjoy that. Ashanti, did you like it?
again, this is a film that I should have really liked. You know, it had, I went to an all-girls school for my secondary years, and everything about this, especially with the fact that these girls, I assume, had, like, their home lives were probably quite oppressed, just like their school lives. And, you know, I remember that I had to get home by kind of 4 p.m. School ended at 3:30, that kind of thing. And what you said, Jane, was exactly it. I had this kind of perturbing feeling when these characters were unraveled to me. After the film, I went and looked who made this film, who wrote this film, and it's two men, no women on the writing team. The director has just taken a bunch of girls from his head and put this on screen. And I think in 2021, or this is made in 2019, I believe, and it's taken a very long time to even get a release, I think by now he should have had some writers to at least assist him with this, to get this a little bit more spot on, because it just sounded like male fantasies being shown on screen with these girls. And these girls were fantastic, really good actors. Marley Sue as Kyla, for example, she was on point. But I just felt that this was a male take on what five girls who went to a Catholic school should have been like. And I didn't feel like they'd actually spoken to any women to characterize these characters. And that for me was worrying. And when I watched it, that's how I felt. And otherwise, yes, exactly everything you've both said, the film, you know, and Edinburgh is beautiful. I'd walked on some of those streets myself, and it felt really nice to watch all of that. And I thought, you know, at the beginning, it has a beautiful sequence where they say, oh, it's all about falling in love in 1996. And I think I went in with high hopes and I came out very disappointed.
I hadn't realized that there were no women involved. And maybe that's why some things felt false, and also just like the lack of danger to it. A lot of these girls and their assumptions about sex are probably because they're in a Catholic school and you're not allowed to talk about it, and this is what they think is expected of them rather than what they really want. But the way it was played was very much like they were just gagging for it, and that they would literally sleep with anyone. I sort of felt like I recognized that need for experience as my own experience at an all-girls school. I totally recognized that curiosity, but what I didn't necessarily recognize was a girl would actually meet someone at 4 a.m. off a train who she'd never really met apart from previously, and have him tie her to a tree in a wood and screw her whilst whipping her with beads. What you actually think you want and actually do want, I think, are very separate things, and that perhaps might have been dealt with a female voice there. I agree with you, Jordan, that it was sort of fun and sort of boisterous, but it lacked a certain responsibility, I suppose, there as well. And also just the fact that if these girls were doing this, as I know from previous experience with, you know, schoolmates of mine, and they were doing that, at some point that wasn't always going to work out for them, and they would probably find themselves in a difficult situation. So again, there was no real problem with the way they're acting. And again, that's not the same as judging them for the way they're acting, but just showing a lack of consequence and the sort of reality of it. So yeah, I agree with both of you.
The only consequences that people face is they get pregnant. That seems to be like the worst thing that can happen in this world.
Yeah, exactly. Which again, I found very kind of false, because it just tarnishes every Catholic schoolgirl of that era with that one brush. You know, it's like you have sex with someone and get pregnant and that's it. You lose the rest of your life.
And that all Catholic schoolgirls are just, you know, rampant sort of sex maniacs. And that's absolutely, as we know, not the case. Mm. But this, I suppose it's only focusing on this one group within that school. It wasn't focusing on the other girls. So there will have been the bookish ones and the nerds and the people who just had very good relationships with their boyfriend and didn't get pregnant and weren't like wanting to have thigh high rubber boots and be strapped to a tree. That whole gamut of those female experiences wasn't shown. But I guess we're just experiencing this particular group's day out in Edinburgh.
And I really struggled to like them. And this was a problem for me, that the likability of these girls, they were written, again, I just felt like it was this male perspective of what a woman should be like. And they didn't etch these characters well enough for me to actually say, oh, I like this one very much. I just felt like, okay, I'm watching it, I'm going along with the story, but who in this set of girls do I even like?
Oh dear.
I quite like them, but I wouldn't want to spend any time with them. Like, I think it would be, I wouldn't want to go on a night out with them. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, exactly. They just were unlikable characters to me.
there was very little kindness on display, wasn't there? Apart from, you know, there's this one scene when, you know, the girl that is closeted opens up slightly to her arch enemy at school. And that was only the real sort of heart of the thing, really. It felt like the group was bound together by bitchiness and sort of being gobby in public spaces, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with that, but that can't just be your only characteristic, you know, and maybe that's what we were lacking. We didn't see much more of them apart from this certain facet of their characters.
Agreed.
Okay, so we're saying go and see it and let's see if you like these girls better than we did and if you have great fun with them. There is potential to have great fun here, but yes, we're saying that we probably would have liked a little bit of a woman's eye on this project. So that is Our Ladies and it is out this Friday at cinemas. So it's time for Plain Talking, where we demystify something from films. And one of the things that needs demystifying is TMZ. We think of it as obviously the very reputable show about papping celebrities and filming them doing their groceries. But what actually is TMZ, Jordan?
Yeah, so this stands for the 30 Mile Zone, which was apparently established in the 1960s by film studios to delineate between anywhere within 30 miles of Hollywood and beyond that, in the sense that if you're working within those 30 miles, you would get sort of standard pay for your work. And if you're working outside of that 30 mile zone, you would get extra pay for being in a kind of remote location, which is possibly part of the reason why you still get films set, you know, all over America that are shot in LA. Though less so nowadays, I guess, because tax breaks seem to be much more important than a 30 mile zone price reduction. Yeah, that's basically it.
Lovely. So that is TMZ. It is not just a load of men sat around drinking coffee talking about who they've papped. It is an actual cinematic historical lore. Okay, so let's move on from teenage girls in Scotland to teenage girls in a very different world with this.
وبعدين اللي واثقة في النظر نفسها ما بتعملش الحاجات دي تلاقي برا شوية يا ربو
هتصلي؟
لا هرقص
So this is Suad, Ashanti. What's this one about?
Okay, so this one is in a similar way to the film we just spoke about, Our Ladies. This is about ladies in Egypt. It is set in Alexandria, where Aiten Amin actually is from. And she's a female director who has really embraced that kind of female experience of sexual awakening in today's world where it's all about your mobile phone. So a lot of the time you just don't know who someone is talking to. Who is someone sexting, sending nudes to? We just don't know, because it's a very private and very isolated world. And whilst everyone seems to be very happy, I'm doing really well in school, da-da-da-da-da. Obviously, on social media, that's the world we create for ourselves. But is it really our real world? And that's what this explores, because it's about two sisters. Just in the first scene itself, you see this girl. She's sitting in a bus, talking to random strangers, supposedly telling them all about her life, only to think, why has she told two different people two very different stories about herself? And then you realize, okay, something's up here. And the film kind of unravels, and these two girls, you know, they're sisters. They show a lot of what goes behind the scenes of these girls who on the outside have perhaps a hijab on, or they're wearing some kind of head covering. But when they're indoors and when they're with their friends, they can talk about lingerie, they can talk about makeup, you know, and boys. With this girl, they show us a facet of hers that immediately feels slightly perturbing, because she looks like she's a normal girl. And then you see her sending these messages, and they don't show us these messages. So in most films where they're showing texts, they show us messages. In this case, we don't see a single message on screen. Well, they show us some mobile phones where you can see some words in Arabic, but you can't actually see these. You can't see any subtitles for these messages. So it's just her and her emotions. And she's an excellent actress. A lot of the cast in this film weren't even actors, so they've actually got them to enact this really well. And, you know, this young girl finds out that, well, she's living in this house. Her sister, who's otherwise okay, pretty normal, actually kills herself. And the minute that happens, she dies by suicide. And the minute that happens, this girl's world unravels around her. She wants to know why they look at her mobile phone and start to find little ideas of what has been going on in her life and what has made her do this. And the rest of the film is about this young girl, her sister, who's quite a traditional girl. So compared to the sister who actually kills herself, this little girl, the young girl, she's actually very much more into the culture and the traditions. And she goes on this journey to find out what is happening in her life. You know, her sister was 19 years old, had everything to live for. Nothing gave any of her friends or family an indication that something was wrong. But once this happens, what you see is how her family also deal with it. So her mother says things like, well, this was God's will for her. And now she's gone. She's at peace. We will have to accept that this is what God has willed for her. This really felt, again, slightly slow burner. You have to really watch it carefully. If you don't speak Arabic and understand Arabic, you have to read those subtitles very carefully to see how this all plays in front of us and how these three lives really, because it's between these two sisters and this one guy that the sister who has killed herself has been texting. So she has had a relationship with this guy. Who is he? Is he everything he has told her that he was, etc., etc.? And this young 13-year-old who's in Alexandria decides to go and find out because she needs to know what has happened to her sister. So it's a very deep film. And I have to say, I'm so impressed with how they brought so many different topics about this world to us in this one film.
Yeah, it gives you a really good sense of living in Egypt. It's so sort of fly on the wall in the way that it sort of moves around and follows this young woman that we start with. And then sort of within, halfway through, it switches to following a totally different young woman. And the woman that you thought you were investing in is taken out of the frame, quite literally. And then the girl you've sort of seen on the periphery comes into her own. So there's a lot of questions about womanhood, what's proper, what society expects of women, as you say, the outside and the interior life of women and all of that. I loved all those scenes where they're sort of in their bedroom talking about fancy knickers for their dowry, but and dancing around and doing things that is considered improper. And then one of their friends is saying, oh my goodness, we need to pray. This clashing of these worlds and that actually do live all in one. There are girls doing the dancing in the bedroom, but also praying. We can sort of draw a bit of a parallel here with our ladies in as much as nobody is just one thing. So, yeah, I found it a fascinating insight into a world I really hadn't known a great deal about. Did you like it, Jordan?
I did. Again, I didn't love this one, I have to say, because I feel like we've seen a lot of films recently that have, you know, tackled this idea of social media and its effects on young minds, you know, everything from eighth grade to Sweat, which we reviewed a couple of months back. This definitely felt like one of the more thoughtful and interesting takes, particularly because as you both said, it's how social media is affecting people in other cultures. As a piece of storytelling though, and the way the story was constructed, I found it a tiny bit too elusive for me, actually to the point where I found that a little bit of a problem. You know, this big turning point moment that you mentioned in the middle of the film, that just comes and goes, like almost without you noticing what's happened. It literally took me like a minute or two to catch up with what had actually happened. Yeah. And I feel like a different film might have done that moment in a way where there could have been, you know, this huge emotional impact with it. It might have been the more obvious thing to do. Maybe this is the more interesting thing to do. But for me, that moment was kind of robbed of its power because I didn't even realize it had happened until about 2 minutes later. Again,
didn't you think that was sort of like a comment on sort of the fact that women do die all the time and it's sort of a data that is unremarked upon and that they sort of do, this does happen?
You can absolutely read that into it, no question. But for me, in the way this story was constructed, it just did, that moment didn't work for me as a piece of storytelling. This has already been mentioned as well, of course, but the fact that we get really no insight into why this has happened.
Yeah.
Really, we don't really understand what her relationship is with Ahmed, who's this character, person who she's having this digital relationship with. You really do have to piece it all together. And I can totally understand where you're coming from by, you know, putting these forwards as things which are going for the film, which make this film great. But for me, It just made it a bit too obtuse as a bit of storytelling for me to really get into it. I felt like I was playing catch up more than I was actually invested in the story. Maybe I need to watch it again now that I kind of had
it. Now you know what's going to happen.
I agree with you, Jordan, in a lot of points there, because it's the way they've told this story, because they weren't giving us those messages as obvious messages either. You had to kind of watch out for them, and it was really hard work to watch. So this isn't that kind of breezy film in any sense, even though they have those little breezy moments at the beginning. The film then becomes quite hard work. And that's one thing I would say, is that go in with the right frame of mind, because it's got a lot of bits that are quite disturbing. And yes, we do get to see this world that we don't, you know, otherwise get shown, and seeing behind the scenes of what goes on with these women. And we have seen some other films like this. And yes, I see Jordan's point. It is a little bit of hard work to get through.
Yeah, it's sort of a bit reminding me of The Candidate, the story of the woman who was going to stand for council, and being able to see where all the women were together and without their proper headwear and the things that they got up to in rooms behind closed doors. A little bit of that. I don't know, I like the hustle and bustle of being on a bus with her and walking through the streets and that. It felt like I really got a sense of that place as well.
The POV shots really worked for me, because I like that, especially the point where she's walking down and she sees the bridge and she knows that'll work for social media. So she stops
to have a photo.
Yes, to have a photo, and you see there's like a body of water and you see a mosque, and she's captured that. And I've been to Alexandria, to that city, so it felt really nice to see it, because we don't get shown Egypt very much, and cities like this that are ancient cities, it's interesting to see also the ruins around all of that as well. And it wasn't all pristine and perfect. It's not been gentrified, that whole place. And it's quite good to kind of get glimpses of all of that.
Yes, and whilst we can't travel, we like a bit of looking at other cities, don't we?
I quite enjoyed that Ahmed is like a content creator for social media as well. I thought that was just quite funny. He just didn't strike me as a content creator at all, but that was quite fun, because he's quite just a dour, straight chef. And I was like, wow, you do not strike me as someone who's, you know, dabbing on TikTok or whatever.
Exactly. The minute she said to him, so what do you do for a living? And he says that, I'm a content creator. I want to know the Arabic words for that, you know, because that's just such a thing that you only hear. I've only been hearing it in the last 2 years.
Content creator. We're all content creators. We're content creating right now. So if you would like to see Suad, it is now out in cinemas on Friday. Okay, time to look at something on streaming. And it's time to go on vacation again with this.
Excuse me, this is a private event.
Oh, it's cool. We know the bride and groom.
We met these two animals down in Mexico.
Why does the salt not taste salty?
Oh, because it's cocaine.
What? We actually brought it from home. Very, very easy if you ever want to try it. It's just a Ziploc and a full shampoo bottle.
And it's so much more comfortable than when I had it in my ass.
Okay, so this is Vacation Friends. Jordan, I know you love a bit of John Cena. Were you pleased with this? Him. Tell us what John is doing in this one.
Oh, what isn't he doing in this film? He gets up to all sorts. So this is directed by Clay Tarver and written by 5 people. But 2 of those people, I will point out, are Jonathan Goldstein and John Francis Daley, who made Game Night and the Vacation sequel, which are 2 of my favorite American comedies of the last 10 years. So I did have quite high hopes for this. Not entirely realized, but I did have a good time. So it stars Lil Rel Howery, who most recently popped up in Free Guy, of course, and Yvonne Orji as Marcus and Emily, who are on holiday in Mexico, where Marcus has planned this elaborate romantic proposal. But when they open the door to their room, it looks like a kind of hurricane has passed through, because the people in the room above overfill their hot tub and cause a flood into their room. And the couple staying in that room, of course, are John Cena and Meredith Hanger, Ron and Kyla. They're this totally wild, free-spirited pair who convince Marcus and Emily to stay in their presidential suite, this kind of opulent room that they somehow got. And they end up spending every waking moment of the rest of this holiday drinking, partying, and becoming quote-unquote vacation friends. So once the holiday's over, Marcus and Emily have no intention to stay friends with these people, to just leave them behind in Mexico and get on with their lives. Cut to 7 months later, Marcus and Emily are about to get married. It's an extremely fraught situation anyway, because Emily's father doesn't approve of Marcus, And Emily's father is pretty much running the show because he's paying for the wedding, as he's a very forceful man. So when Ron and Kyla literally crash the wedding with their pickup truck, you know, Marcus is horrified by this turn of events. They've just turned up asking, why the hell weren't we invited to this wedding? We're your best friends. We're your vacation friends. But, you know, Ron, being the charismatic chap that he is, very quickly ingratiates himself with Emily's family and gets himself an invite to the wedding and, you know, the presidential suite, of course. So now Marcus has to navigate his way through the build-up to this wedding with Ron, who almost without fail makes things worse at every turn by his side. It's just a dumb film. Very dumb film. It made me chuckle pretty consistently, I have to say. Most of the humor for me came from the fact that Ron is just this super keen, like, puppy of a man who has this bizarre set of skills. Like, he can tell, for example, when a bird is going to do a poo, which has like a ridiculous payoff later in the film.
Yeah.
It's just a lot of very silly stuff. They get high in the woods when they're doing this like fox chase at one point. Is this a tradition in America?
Do Americans do fox hunting? Because I was like, I thought that was a bit weird.
I just thought only idiotic Brits did that, but apparently it's an American thing as well. So yeah, it's fun. It's very stupid. I think it's probably fair to say that the fact this is debuting on Disney Plus rather than in cinemas is sort of a sign of how much you can expect to enjoy this. It wouldn't be worth forking out for a cinema ticket, but if you've got nothing else to watch on Netflix on a Friday night, you'll probably enjoy this. It's probably missing one or two gut-bustingly funny set pieces, which would have set it apart from the crowd and help it stick in the memory. Like, I watched it at the weekend, and to be honest, I'm struggling to remember most of the things that I laughed at this point. I remember laughing, so it must have worked to a certain extent.
Ashanti, do you remember anything you laughed at, or did you indeed laugh?
So, I mean, we've seen a lot of John Cena this year, right? F9, then, you know, the Suicide Squad, and then this one. And this seemed to be a very different outing, although it's like he plays that same character every time, just wearing different clothes maybe, you know. And I wanted to like this film so much. I really did, you know. Even it's got people like Lynn Whitfield in it. She was in Greenleaf, a TV show that I absolutely loved. And Yvonne Orji, you know, I grew up in Nigeria. She's Nigerian. She's a comedian who does amazing comedy. I absolutely loved her. You know, she's done quite a lot of stuff. And she's very good in all of it. So I don't know, when I watched this, I mean, especially for me, I'd been a fan in Insecure, and, you know, Lil Rel has been in lots of TV shows I've seen. So I really wanted to like it. And I feel like I'm coming across really negative this week, but I just felt like the film fell very short for me. And I think it should have been a lot more funny. I think that one thing I did like about it was the fact that you don't really get to see kind of rich black couples very much in cinema. So that was really nice. I thought it was quite good that they brought that angle in. These are people who have, you know, very comfortable lives. Yvonne Orji's parents are very well to do. This Lil Rel himself has got his own business. He's doing really well for himself. So that was a really nice thing to see. And normally this film would have been, I guess it would have been John Cena and like five other people, but it was nice to see a black couple put into that. So that felt good. But all around the film, just, it was a little bit, like you said, Jane, a little bit weird in places. And I think they were trying to tap out humor through those weird bits, but it just didn't work for me.
I had quite a good time with it. I just do like John Cena. I like that he turned up with his hair on end, and it always was on end. As you say, Jordan, he's like a sort of a lab dog trapped in a man's body, just like, yeah, let's do that. You know, it's like the opposite to The Nest, you know, watching one man just self-destruct. This one was like, I enjoyed watching him just do stuff that's clearly ill-advised. And but also the joy with which he does it, and the sort of the place of sort of he's coming from is not to destroy somebody's life, although that's what he does, is just to have the best fun. And he says at one point, you know, he and his wife, if they haven't spent all the money, then, you know, they're not having enough fun. And they're idea is to really live life to the max. And frankly, I can sort of get behind that idea, just not to the extent, obviously, that they do. But I thought there was enough jokes that were silly enough to sort of tickle me. It didn't outstay its welcome. It was sort of a bit like Meet the Parents at some points. And, you know, I sort of enjoyed that. And I also always, I know you shouldn't compare people, but I always think about John Cena and The Rock. And I think I just couldn't imagine The Rock being this silly, because The Rock is great fun. And I, you know, I do enjoy him as an actor. But I think Cena is willing to be really quite silly. And he does some really dumb stuff in this that I like. And I also liked he took the piss out of himself with the Mexican wrestling scene, saying, hey, anyone can do this. You know, a little nod to his own career. So for me, it was entirely disposable, but it was like having a little bit of a holiday with stupidity, as the characters do in the film. And I liked my 90 minutes on holiday with stupidity, so I would sort of recommend that people watch it. I think you need a margarita with a salt rim, we should say. Yes. Nothing else.
So I was just going to say that I think had I watched this film with nibbles and cocktails, I think I would have liked it. So, you know, it probably was the setting I had put myself in, thinking, oh, I'm going to laugh at all of this and love it and not have a cocktail by my side. So next time I might give it another run.
Yeah,
with a margarita, with just salt, maybe a touch of sugar and nothing else.
Yes, nothing else. So that's Vacation Friends, which is available on Disney Plus from Friday. So enjoy that. Right, before we go, it is time for a reader's question. I picked this one out of our many because I thought this goes with the fact that we've been on holiday in this show for quite a bit. So what's the best resort film? A film set at a resort?
This was an extremely tough question because when you say resort, I think beach resort. I couldn't think of any film set at a beach resort. I could only think of Forgetting Sarah Marshall.
Exactly.
And that truly terrible couples retreat film with Vince Vaughn. So, you know, just by default, basically, Forgetting Sarah Marshall.
Old is at a resort.
I was going to say Old. True.
I haven't seen Old yet, so.
Oh, you must.
I couldn't pick that. Yeah.
Old is still in cinemas. Please, please see it because it really is very, very good. You know, Old, of course, will take you into a different world, though, because, yes, it's a resort. Just like White Lotus, you're thinking, oh, it's a very beautiful place. But it can also put you off going to resorts. So approach with caution. But Old is a fantastic film. Highly recommended. It's on a podcast from a few weeks ago as well that we talked about it and many of us liked it. From my perspective, I wanted to pick Dirty Dancing because that was set on a resort. Not quite a beach resort, but a resort. And, you know, no one puts baby in the corner. I had the time of my life watching it, blah, 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 blah. I really liked it. And it really makes me sad that I have to talk about Patrick Swayze in the past now, because sadly he passed away. And him with Jennifer Grey in that was fantastic. But, you know, the other resort film for me was How Stella Got Her Groove Back, because Angela Bassett, she's turned 60. Nobody would believe it because she looks so, so, so good. And Taye Diggs with Whoopi Goldberg and Regina King, young Regina King. You know, what can I say? That's the magical resort film that I absolutely loved.
Good one. Obviously, as I love Dirty Dancing, I was going to say Dirty Dancing, Kellerman's Resort in the Catskills, absolute cracker. But also I would say the Del Mar, Barb and Star's visit there. What a wonderful place to go in Florida, where, you know, there's mystical beings in the ocean and there's Jamie Dornan doing Dancing on the Sand. But also a shout out to Some Like It Hot for the beautiful hotel that they go to stay in San Diego, which I actually went to stay in because I'm that sad. As you know, I like to go to places that I see on film. And so I did go and stay there, the Hotel Del Coronado in San Diego. And it is a beautiful sort of Victorian red roofed hotel, this beautiful resort on a gorgeous beach. But one of the best things about it is it's opposite the Top Gun base. So when you sit on your balcony looking at the sea, having your drink, the jets are taking off. And then if you hire one of the bikes to cycle around the island that it's on, often you're going past a load of Top Gun pilots like jogging in their Top Gun t-shirt with their dog tags on. I very sadly didn't see anyone playing topless volleyball on the beach. It's a shame, but that was a pretty damn good resort. So I'm saying that one. Let us know on Twitter if you have any favourite resort films. And for now, I think we'll say goodbye. Thanks so much for joining us, Ashanti and Jordan.
My pleasure.
Bye.
Bye.